This podcast takes you into the rarely discussed realm of the personal decisions leaders have taken that have influenced their business decisions and developed them into the leaders they are today. The refreshingly honest experiences of those who have been very successful provide an insight into the challenges they faced, the successes they achieved, and the people who influenced them along their journey. Here's our host, Mark Silvera.
Hey, welcome to Business Made Personal. Thanks so much for downloading us again. We really appreciate your support. Today, I have with me Gary Gribben. And Gary entered the general insurance industry in 1969. You don't look that old, Gaz. And moved into broking in 1976 when he was transferred to London, where he had a varied body of professional experience, including underwriting agencies, international broking, US treaty reinsurance broking, UK and LMX broking. In 84, Gary returned to Australia in an academic position as head of insurance and risk management, replacing the late Warren Tickle, who had become insurance commissioner at that stage. Gary spent 20 years in that academic position whilst providing consultancy services to a wide range of organisations, including law firms, insurance companies, insurance brokers, Harvard, international companies, and IBNA as the director and chairman. Gary then had an extensive involvement in medical indemnity and medical malpractice segments, which led ultimately to a return to insurance broking with Insurance House. The man is known for his love of Hawaiian shirts and for speaking his mind. Gary is currently non-executive chairman of Insurance House, Queensland Insurance Brokers, and Axis Underwriting, and he continues to be closely involved in the general insurance industry. So pleased to have you on Business Made Personal, Gary.
Lovely to see you, old friend.
Hey, Gary, your accent is very educated, so, you know, it smacks of the UK, but you grew up in Australia?
Yes, I was born in Seymour and for many years moved around Victoria as a young child. Ultimately, I had the pleasure of attending more than 20 primary schools and managed to attend three different secondary schools.
Were your folks in the armed forces or something?
No, my father was a truck driver when he was around, but my mother moved around quite a lot.
Right, and you went with her, obviously.
Too right.
Was that a difficult thing for you to do as a young child?
No, not at all. I was the oldest of six, and change in abode seemed to be the custom rather than something that was different. We didn't see it as being particularly exotic or different moving all the time.
Most young people say they struggled with relationships because they couldn't establish any if they were moving that often. But I guess with that number of siblings, you may not have felt the need for it.
No, the only fights were over food.
And they still are today.
Indeed.
Gary, you worked in Australia and overseas. Were there any challenges you faced overseas that you never expected?
Not really, in truth. At the time I went to London, Mark, middle 70s, London was still very much a market dominated by Eton, Harrow, Oxbridge and the Guards. It tended to be a market that had greatest reliance on relationships, particularly social relationships, more so than technical abilities and knowledge. So I guess I was warned before I went there, having plenty of rough edges, a naturally combative personality that perhaps I wouldn't like it and wouldn't thrive. But timing is everything in life, and one of the fortuitous events for me was that I arrived in London at a time when the market was expanding massively and where I think the realisation had come that they needed a lot more than the old school brigade if the market was indeed to perform the functions that it needed to perform. So at the time, as a technician, predominantly, I didn't have the luxury of years of old school relationships. It was a good environment for me. It was a quite fruitful environment. And to that end, I was very fortunate indeed.
So I wasn't aware that you, even in those days, were, let's call it a combative personality, as you said. Did that stand you in good stead in that environment?
Surprisingly, it did. Initially, when I got to London and started broking in the room, the old Lloyds, I was counselled to be very respectful, very quiet, doff the lid, tug the forelock and all of that. But that wasn't my style. I was far more direct, I think, professional in doing it. I hope so anyway. Other people are probably best left to judge that. But the fact that I was able to survive, and not simply to survive, but to prosper and create my own strong reputation and following, I think self-evidently that that was the right thing to do. I think we always have to be true to ourselves. As insurance brokers, I'm often saying, well, there's a bit of an actor in all of us as insurance brokers. We're there as advocates, we're there as presenters, we cajole, we persuade, we seek to influence. So there's a bit of the chameleon in all good insurance brokers. The things that are not negotiable are integrity and honesty, because we all know once you learn to fake those, everything else is easy.
So you and I have known each other for a couple of years. And whilst you may say that you've got a combative personality, I have never come across that without you having great backing and great knowledge and experience around your positioning. So you tend not to open your mouth unless you know that you're factually correct. Would that be a correct assumption?
I think in common with most people, I don't go out looking for an argument. But if one arises, a matter of principle, then I'll argue. In London, I was very forceful in representing the interests of my clients, whether it be American insurance companies where I was transacting reinsurance programs or syndicates where I was transacting LMX programs. We're there to represent the client. That's the interest that prevails. It's not about me, it's about the client. So in doing that piece of work, do it to the best of your ability and do it as forcefully as needs be. Sometimes I needed to be abrupt, sometimes forceful, other times perhaps verging on obsequious.
Do you think that we do that enough in the current profession?
Right as we sit, it's one of the hardest markets most brokers in Australia have experienced. It was hard back in 2010-11 when we had all the catastrophes, 11 open catastrophes with the ICA. That was a depth of catastrophe experience that I'd never seen before. So for a time afterwards, in 2012, things got very sticky, but not to the same extent that they are now, where we've got some real, in some respects, some real gouging going on. There are certain groups, industrial and commercial groups, certain professional risks that are now verging on impossible to place. We've got geographic red lines in abundance. So I don't think the industry and brokers have been presented with the same level of challenge historically that they are contemporarily. That's coincided with a typical insurance industry response to difficult conditions. Insurance companies cut out the middle. So they've really dumbed it down. It seems to me there's a massive shortage of high-quality expertise. In broking, it's evident. It's very clearly evident in underwriting. The money that underwriters are paying to brokers to seduce them to the dark side is quite astounding. And a great many of our clients are really suffering very badly at a point where it's beginning, I think, to leach into the economic fabric, because a lot of businesses are threatened with viability issues because of the pricing, where they can get it, or the complete absence.
I must say, I've heard a lot of stories of businesses saying, I can't afford that. I'm going to halve my sum insured, so at least I've got some insurance.
One can have sympathy with them in that respect. The well of human kindness isn't without limit. Insurers have a right to make profits. I think we just have a confluence of events. There's very little return for them in investment markets, in capital markets. So underwriting must stand on its own feet, but the response in a number of areas, I think, has been perhaps over the top.
I want to change tack a little bit and completely unrelated to what we've just been speaking about, but you're well known for your Hawaiian shirts.
Love an Hawaiian shirt.
Where did that love start from, Gary?
I don't really know. I can't actually pinpoint that, Mark. There's no one particular incident. People say, why do you like Hawaiian shirts? So it's very simple. I'm not wearing one today because I wanted to unsettle you. You would have anticipated me wearing a Hawaiian shirt. First thing I'll do is unbalance Silvera by wearing a bog-standard business shirt. But people say, why do you wear them? Why do you like them so much? And there's a very simple reason for it. Every time I've got a Hawaiian shirt on and walk up to someone, they smile. It does make people happy. It does put a smile on the dial. And so it's a conversation starter. It's a relaxing introduction. I enjoy them. It probably aligns with my personality to be a bit loud.
Well, you certainly know you're there, right? Which is a great thing.
Well, I'm not 7 feet tall like Robert Kelly. I needed something.
Just thinking about your career, and I said at the start, you kicked off in 1969. What has the industry given you that you personally never expected to get out of it?
Almost everything. In the manner of A.B. Facey, Mark, I've had a fortunate life. I fell into insurance broking, as so many of us did. In my case, I had a friend who was a broker with Tolly Gardner and Bishop, and we played cricket together. I was wondering what I'd do with myself because I lost my university scholarships through non-attendance in the final year of high school. So I needed to go out and work anyway. So he told me about examinations, the associateship examinations, part one and two in the insurance industry. If you passed those, people thought you were smart and you got ahead. I thought, well, examinations, that's easy. I've always been good at those. So I joined the insurance industry, joined Prudential back then, who were advertising for an experienced fire and accident underwriter aged 30 to 40. Not knowing up from down, left from right in insurance, I applied for it and was given the job. 2 weeks later, in modern parlance, I had unlimited underwriting authority. So just an appalling piece of management on the part of the Prudential, who got lucky because I understood that I knew nothing. Again, I made some good decisions along the way. I did my part one in a single sitting. And at the time, back then, that sort of didn't happen. Most of the people at Prudential signed up for the subjects, and if they passed a subject at a sitting, they were doing well. A lot of them just didn't turn up for exams. It was all a bit of a joke, a bit of a laugh. But I was promoted. I was given opportunities. I moved quickly out of underwriting into broking. 1976, I moved into broking. Once I'd finished my degree, because I went on and did a degree, was part of the original cohorts who benefited from Warren Tickle at Perrant. I moved on to broking with Bailey Baring, CT Baring, and moved to London. And from there, a mixture of good fortune and some good decisions, perseverance, and always building as much technical expertise, as much knowledge, and as many relationships as I could. So for me, what I've got out of it is a universe of friends. I've been able to travel all over the world because of the insurance industry. I've worked in London and New York. I did work in Asia. Extensive work for Harvard in Asia in executive education. So very, very fortunate indeed. And even today, probably 85% of my friends are from the industry and they remain very, very close and dear to me.
Speaking of friends and colleagues, who has been the most influential person in your life, Gary?
Undoubtedly my mother. I was fortunate that a few months prior to her death, I was able to tell her in the company of my friends at a social event that she was, in fact, the person I admired most in the world. She was so incredibly hardworking, wonderfully determined, terrific sense of humour, in every respect, the most splendid person you could ever wish to meet. Professionally, there have been a lot of people along the way. I still remember a secondary school English teacher called John Bidder, who was fantastic. I can remember at different stages, lots of people having an influence, a very positive influence. And I can remember some who didn't have a particularly good influence, as we all can.
Sometimes they say they're as important as the ones who've had a positive influence because you know what not to do in the future.
Remember that I was in London through till 84, so I was witness to a great many of, shall we say, fraudulent, inappropriate activities. And they were disgraceful. And the mere fact that it took the Lloyd's Committee so long to understand that baby syndicates was a terribly unsophisticated form of insider trading, the worst sort of positive selection in favour of a pleasured group one could imagine, and yet it was tolerated for years and years and years.
How did you work in that environment? Because that would have been challenging for someone like you.
I wasn't there to reform the market. I was there to work on behalf of my clients, of the company's clients. And so I reminded myself of that. At the end in London, I was in effect not specialising, but I was charged with a lot of the very heavy lifting, the very difficult casualty retrocessional accounts. and on some of the extremely technical placements, things like time and distance, portfolio transfers and the like.
I want to read something from Robert Cooper, who's the director at CPR Insurance Services. Gary Gribben was lecturer and mentor for me when I was doing my fellowship at the Australian Insurance Institute, then a graduate diploma of insurance at Deakin University. He then encouraged me to go for my MBA. I have valued his calming nature through stressful moments in completing these courses, his patience and kindness. I have enjoyed his presentations whenever he has visited Queensland. I appreciate his friendship and knowing he will always offer his help if I ever have to call on him. Gary Gribben is one of the best people in our industry. Do you think we're as supportive of each other as we should be in this insurance profession, Gary?
By and large, yes, I think we are. At its best, it's a caring and sharing business. I'm always loath, as I think you know, to refer to it as a profession. I don't think that we have yet achieved that objective because we don't have an efficient regime of occupational regulation. Hopefully that will come, but it's been a long time in the offing. Yes, by and large, I've got a fantastic network of friends. At its very best, was all about that. It was about sharing, very much about sharing. For me, it was just a fabulous journey over 20 years with friends. An economic purpose for me, the fact that in the end, a sale was negotiated with Steadfast, recognised the extraordinary nature of IBNA. And that proved, frankly, to be the best deal I've ever been involved with because it was a massive win for the IBNA members and, I believe, a transaction that was terrific for Steadfast, a real win-win. I was invited to present, I think, at their second ever conference up at the Conrads. I used to have a conference, two-day event prior to the NIBA convention. So I presented at that 2 years in a row. That coincided with them becoming a public company, then formed the view that they needed someone from outside their fraternity to be on the board. So I was invited to join the board as, if you like, an independent director. I did that and the rest, as they say, is history.
Yeah, so you joined as an independent director. Now, you and I go back to the 80s. My recollection was IBNA was heavily reliant on your contribution to the strategic direction of the organisation. Would I be right in saying that?
Well, I hope that I was able to make a contribution. If not, they were wasting their time and so was I. Some battles.
I mean that for me, on the outside, it looked as though you were really leading the charge in terms of where that cluster group went.
As the chairman, obviously, that was my responsibility to do just that. Prior to becoming chairman, I worked with some excellent people. Mark Patterson was a great chairman of IBNA when he was there and remains a terrific friend, even though he turned out to be a traitorous, went to Austbrokers. But Paddo remains a wonderful friend and was a great chairman. Marty Owen was a wonderful director of IBNA. We had other excellent people around the table and we worked very collaboratively. The mantra at IBNA I did invent, I'll take credit for that. It was all about collegiality. We didn't have to agree with each other all the time, but when we disagreed, we had to disagree in an agreeable manner. That is to be professional. It was never personal. We may have professional differences, but by and large, that was the hallmark of IBNA, collegiality. Strategically, yes, I was obviously involved in establishing some of the objectives and in pursuing those.
So in 2019, you were awarded the Lex McEwen Lifetime Achievement Award. NIBA president at the time was a gentleman by the name of Eric Harris, and he said of you, and I quote, "Gary is the kind of guy who will always challenge you, and he always has the answer to most conundrums." How important is it to you to continue challenging the status quo?
I think we should all be doing that all the time. I think it's incumbent upon any professional person to examine the environment critically and to be questioning of it, to question motives in an appropriate manner, not a rude manner, to be questioning strategy, to be doing as much analysis and examination, critical examination, as they possibly can. So, yes, I think it's a vital component of our professional life.
So some of the people listening to this will be, you know, people who are a little bit younger or who are in middle management or those sort of start positions. What advice would you give them in terms of them challenging the status quo? Because, you know, often those people have brilliant ideas, having not been tainted by what's gone on in the past.
I think that's a very fair point. So often we're guilty of relying upon the past and imputing that to the future. And yet when we sit back for just a second and think about it, there's only one thing we know about the future, isn't there? It'll be nothing like the past. It's quite extraordinary that we still look to the past. It's difficult in a lot of organisations to get the point across, but I think keep pushing it in the right way. People aren't going to imperil themselves and make themselves unpopular by smashing into brick walls, I hope, but stick at it, be persistent, because persistence does have its reward. Be appropriately critical, but always constructive. It's easy to criticise, but the criticism is only useful if it's constructive, if it's productive. So try and engage the creative side of the brain. Think about how we're doing things. Is there a better way to do it? And then to have the courage to stick your head out a bit.
So in that same year, there was an article in Insurance News by Terry McMullen, and it is said of you, and I quote that article, "You are respected as much for his huge intellect as his ability to indulge in colourful outbursts of plain speaking." Do you think we complicate things in the insurance profession?
Inevitably. I mean, we have a very, very rich and varied jargon that exists to exclude the uninitiated, to make it sound important and complex, and we really do need to demystify and not dumb it down, but plain speaking is important.
Do you think that those changes, you know, the UK changes, the Asia changes, the Australian changes, do you think that had an impact on your personal life?
Well, it meant that friendships from time to time were abrupted. We all try hard, but there is tyranny associated with distance, and I still have friendships with a number of people I work with in London. I was really happy in Adelaide at the Steadfast Conference recently to be able to spend some time with John Palmer and Nick Porritt. I hadn't seen Nick for years, but we worked together in the old days, EW Payne in London, and when we were together having a chat, it was as though the years just peeled back. Instead of them being very young men, they're middle-aged and I'm very old.
I know the feeling. Gary, if you were able to go back to that young boy that was moving schools and moving houses, knowing what you know now, what advice would you give him?
I guess there are times when I was perhaps too flippant about things. There are also some matters about which I was too serious. So I guess maybe arriving at a better balance. It could be said that of me at that time that I was prone to extremes. That's life. I got through it. I'd have probably been a bit more serious about my sport if I had the time over, but otherwise I wouldn't change anything. We are what we are.
Are you saying that at that point in time that you were given more to outbursts? Is that what you're trying to get at? Or
I can remember something Form 2, it's that Year 8 teacher wrote about me. He said, "Gary has achieved an outstanding academic record. However, a little less flippancy, self-indulgence and pointless argument would be a worthwhile small improvement." And my mother said to me, "What in heaven's name does he mean?" And I said to her, "Well, he's just saying that I'm a smarter." And she said, "Well, why didn't he write that?"
Good thing you've changed.
Not much.
In 2011, you produced The Principles of Risk and Insurance for Deakin University. Was there anything that specifically stood out for you about the industry when you were compiling that material?
No. The Insurance Contracts Act came into being in 1984. In 2011 and now, in 2022, the one thing that staggers me, continues to stagger me, Mark, is how poorly understood within underwriting offices the Insurance Contracts Act is. I think as the principal piece of regulation governing the relationship between policyholder and insurer, that it is a fundamentally important piece that ought to be second nature in respect of the major points to all people in underwriting. And insurers conduct themselves in a manner that you have to wonder sometimes whether they're aware of the existence of the Act. You still see insurers purporting to cancel policies midterm for on a basis that is simply not permitted by Section 60 of the Act, failing to comply with Section 58, claims handling that clearly breaches the good faith sections of the Act. And it's quite astounding, because when you talk to the underwriters, when you talk to the claims people, it's a mystery. They seem not to understand the Act. One wonders whether it ever really did come into existence, whether it was proclaimed.
We know it was, because you and I met at Peran College in the 80s when the Act was a predominant conversation point. But even in those days, you know, even when I worked for different insurers at that point in time, that Act was like the Bible. You had to know it. Do you think that we've lost a little bit of our way due to us dumbing down the underwriting process? Or do you think there's some other reason why we're not as well-versed in things like that?
I think you're right. I think it has been dumbed down. In the SME market, everything is going down the tube, whether it be the SCTP or Sunrise. Insurers want it down the tube. They've withdrawn, effectively, underwriting authority or genuine underwriting authority from their so-called underwriters. And if it doesn't immediately fit down the tube, they just don't want to know about it. So they're not crafting skilled underwriters. It's a bit like going back to the old tariff days, 1976, when underwriting was knowing where to look in the tariff, you know, 2,500 fine print pages. Now we've got underwriters who aren't underwriters. And we do have a lot of brokers who aren't brokers. They're just data processors who put things down the tube.
What do you see as being a potential solution?
I'm not sure there is one now. The future has been crafted from an underwriting expense perspective and from an underwriting control perspective. Insurance companies have made it clear that they don't want authority in the hands of people. People are going to be influenced by brokers. The machine isn't. So maybe it will turn and companies will become better at it, but brokers have been complicit in it because as brokers, we want to do business quickly and easily and efficiently as well as effectively. So for the bulk of our business, you know, we're happy just to stick it down the tube and get frustrated when the 10% doesn't fit down the tube. And it's becoming a greater frustration now simply because of that, what I call the withdrawal of underwriting authority and discretion.
You know, you're one of these people, Gary, that's highly sought after to sit on boards, including chairmanships throughout Australia and overseas. What is it in your background that people resonate toward and see that you bring value? Is it your experience? Is it your education? Is it the fact that you've got a background in law, the fact that you've got a background in accounting? What is it specifically do you think that people value in those board and chairmanship positions?
I guess it's all of those. They each play their contributing role. At the end of the day, I hope it's because people see that I do have an ability to think clearly, to identify a strategy, to divine a strategy if necessary. As chairman, my role is really to dig in and support the chief executive. And in each of the three organisations I chair, I'm fortunate there are really good, strong chief executives to make sure that they're properly resourced and properly encouraged. And obviously, I monitor their performance. So I think it's not one particular issue. I think, you know, given that I'm pushing 71, it's all of them. It's the experience, the background, the relationships. I have good, strong relationships across a great many areas. And if I was to give advice to a younger person, it would be pretty simple advice. Build your technical expertise. Just keep building, building, building. Never neglect. Develop that product knowledge, market knowledge, industry knowledge. Draw on all the resources you possibly can to widen your points of reference and your framework. But at the same time, understand the soft skills, the interpersonal skills are utterly critical. So just keep building relationships. And the relationships have to be at different levels, different technical areas, different levels of organisations, and just keep building those, because at the end of the day, companies are a fiction. We deal, at its best, in our industry, we've always dealt person to person. That, I guess, is the frustration nowadays, that it's now no longer P2P, it's P to machine.
So you were a central figure in the IBNA move from AIMS, as we've discussed, right? So IBNA moved from AIMS to Steadfast, but IBNA members discovered the move from AIMS to Steadfast, just like the rest of us did via the media. Now, that was due primarily to the compulsory requirements of Steadfast as a publicly listed company. It's understood that AUB were disappointed with the outcome. I'm interested to know, Gary, what pressures did you personally face during that time?
Surprisingly few. There'd been a changing of the guard at AUB, so I thought the time was right. Over the years, I'd had many dealings with Robert Kelly, so we put our heads together, and I said in the Terry McMullen article that it took 5 minutes, and that's the absolute truth. It took us 5 minutes to agree. The way forward was, I think, entirely obvious. It didn't require a sophisticated pitch to me from Robert. I'd more or less made up my mind how I wanted it to come out, and I knew very well how he wanted it to come out. That was made clear immediately, so there wasn't any disagreement. It was all about the price, and that too was very quickly agreed and amicably agreed. It was important that it be an appropriate price that recognised that both sides needed to win, and they did.
I guess I'm a little surprised you didn't cop a little bit of flack in the background.
I cop some flack, but that goes with the territory. Obviously, AUB were disappointed. So we moved onwards. Some IBNA members were upset that I hadn't consulted with them, but they didn't need to sell if they didn't want it. But the offer was more than fair. Strategically, it was just a perfect outcome.
At that time, you said, what drove me to talk more seriously to Robert at Steadfast was what I saw as a failure to collaborate in respect of the really key issues that are going to drive the future prosperity of insurance brokers: technology, brand, and strategy. In 2022, how well do you think we are doing in those three areas of technology, brand, and strategy?
Well, nowadays, obviously, the businesses I'm aligned with are part and parcel of Steadfast. Two of them are predominantly owned by Steadfast. I think in relation to technology, Steadfast has done an excellent job. They've built Insight as a broker management system. Seems to me to be terrific. The best people to advise in relation to that are the people who are doing the job day to day. And at Insurance House, at QIB, they're both very, very pleased with Insight. There are always improvements that can be made. And the good thing about Insight and Steadfast is that they listen. So in terms of technology, Steadfast, I believed at the time of the sale, were well in advance of AUB. From an IBNA point of view, we were never going to invent our own technology because there's not space for so many platforms in the market.
No, agreed. And you need volume. You need volume to develop it. You need volume to retain it.
Strategy for each of the businesses has its strategy. Insurance House, we have a very sophisticated strategic plan. It can be placed, however, on a single piece of paper, and it does provide the appropriate guidance and direction and challenges for everyone in the business. What else did you mention?
They were the three things. If you could change one thing about our industry, what would it be, Gary?
I don't know. I truly don't know. There are so many things we get right, and there are so many things we manage to mess up along the way, but that's true of everything. I don't know that there's just any one thing in particular. I think that people working in claims for insurance companies have an awfully difficult job, and they do it, for the most part, really very, very well. I guess the one thing I'd change is the mindset. You ask people in insurance companies what is the role of the insurance company, and they'll talk about underwriting and pricing risk. Well, yeah, that's part of it. Ask our customers what's the role of an insurance company, and they'll tell you it's only one thing, isn't it? Pay claims. So if there was to be one thing I'd change, it would be the mindset. It would be the view, our self-view. Understand that we're there to pay claims. Understand that we're going to be judged on that footing, and I think properly so. And so as brokers, as insurers, we just need to understand that performance isn't conspicuous. It's what's expected of professional organisations who are there to do a particular job. Failures of what's conspicuous. So we somehow have to understand that and to just keep working to reduce, to minimise to the extent possible our failures.
So there'll be people listening to this podcast who are continuing to develop their careers. Do you have any advice for those who are interested in advancing their insurance careers?
Not really beyond what I've already said, Mark, which is about, you know, working assiduously to develop broader and deeper technical competence and relationships. Those are the two things. I think at the moment we've got a lot of movement in the industry, and it's driven predominantly by financial outcomes. The one thing that I think I did get right along the way in my career is I never moved for money. I moved for exposure, for opportunity. And so I would say to younger people, you know, be careful, make decisions to change, because they do give you greater opportunity. They give you greater exposure. They constitute a real platform for you, not just an increased pay packet at the end of the month. So try and develop a longer-term perspective.
Do you think that's a challenge for younger people coming into the industry? Because there is a belief that people coming into the industry these days could have up to 3, 4, 5 careers over their working life.
Well, I've been hearing that for 25 years.
You don't believe that's the case?
It hasn't yet happened. Very few people are reinventing themselves. COVID has probably provided the greatest stimulus imaginable for people to reinvent themselves, and I'm not sure that's happened. It may. I take that suggestion. Once upon a time, I'd say to people, you know, recognise you're going to have 5 or 6 jobs, and people would say, well, nowadays you're going to have 5 or 6 careers. Well, that just hasn't happened. And I say, don't see any sign of it happening.
So two final questions for you, Mr. Gary Gribben. The first one is, you talked about the fact that you lost your university scholarship when you were a younger man, which is, to me, quite ironic, given the fact that you became an academic for 20 years and you subsequently went on and did a whole heap of study yourself. How important is the formal education process for the insurance industry?
Well, I think it's very important. I think if we are to be a profession, then it is the cornerstone on which the profession will be built. If you look at the historical professions, medicine, law, theology, the church, very, very well established minimum education requirements and training and CPD requirements. If we don't have those ultimately, then I don't think we can ever be claiming ourselves as a profession. And it's not just insurance knowledge. And the best studies I did were the broader studies. The MBA was terrific. I'm not a qualified lawyer, but the constant involvement with the law, those are the two that probably have stood me in greatest stead.
And the final question to you, sir. So what's next for Gary Gribben?
More of the same. I have been very lucky. I'm lucky now to have the continuing involvement with Insurance House, with Queensland Insurance Brokers and Axis. I hope that will continue for the next couple of years, and then we'll see. It's great to be involved and working with people I respect, people like Robert Kelly, Stephen Humphries at Steadfast, Jay Faraday at Insurance House, Ivan Vereshchuk and Gary Dawson at Axis, and Tim Matheson at QIB. It's wonderful being around those people, all of whom, apart from Kelly, are younger than I am. And I do think that being around younger people keeps you on your toes and younger. So I hope that I'll continue to have the benefit of that intellectual stimulation, because that's clearly very important.
It definitely is.
Yeah, it's important to my mental well-being. So I guess I'll do that as long as they think I'm making a contribution, as long as it works for me as well. I'm in the fortunate position of not having to do anything that I don't want to do now.
That is fortunate.
It does come with age.
Yep, it certainly does. Gary Gribben, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on Business Made Personal and speak in your colourful plain English. It's been an absolute privilege.
Lovely to spend some time with you, Mark.
Thank you so much for lending us your ears. Please remember to click follow on your podcast app or subscribe at bmppodcast.com.au so we can give you a sneak peek of our next guest. Until next time, I'm Mark Silvera, and you've been listening to Business Made Personal.